You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Casey, and I'll be joined shortly by co-host Dennis Wissman. Our guest today is Andrew J. Scott. He's a professor of economics and former deputy dean at the London Business School and research fellow at the Center for Economic Policy Research. His research focuses on longevity, an aging society, fiscal policy, and debt management, and has been published widely in leading journals. His book with Linda Gratton, The 100-Year Life, has been published in 15 languages. It's an Amazon bestseller and was runner-up in the FT McKinsey Business Book of the Year Award in 2016, as well as the Japanese Business Book of the Year Award in 2017. His recent 2020 book, The New Long Life, considers how the challenges and opportunities of social and technological ingenuity might shape a new age of longer lives. He was managing editor for the Royal Economic Society's Economic Journal and non-executive director for the UK's Financial Services Authority from 2009 to 2013. He has been an advisor on policy to a range of governments and government departments. He is currently on the advisory board of the UK's Office for Budget Responsibility, the Cabinet Office Honours Committee, Science and Technology, co-founder of the Longevity Forum, a member of the UK government's Longevity Council, and the WEF Council on Japan, a consulting scholar at Stanford University's Center on Longevity. With a unique perspective as a global economist, professor, and government advisor, he draws upon a range of disciplines. His groundbreaking work on longevity, economics, and the value and effect technology and longevity combined will have in the wider society is shaped by his professional connections to academia, industry, social pioneers, and policymakers around the world. Andrew previously held positions at Oxford University, London School of Economics, and Harvard University. His MA is from Oxford, his MSc from the London School of Economics, and his doctorate from Oxford University. Professor Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Always very happy to talk issues around longevity.
So there's a lot of media coverage on aging, and it tends to be rather negative. But your book, The New Long Life, makes a strong case for a different narrative. How should we be thinking about aging?
Yeah, I think we got a bit messed up around aging. I mean, I think one of the greatest achievements of the 20th century was the last 100 years, in fact, that we're seeing big increases in life expectancy. And most of those extra years of life have been healthy ones. So the average person today will live longer and be in good health for longer. And that's great news. So we sort of celebrate. But we got a bit messed up, I think. And I think part of the reason is we haven't really realized two things that have happened with longevity, two key things. The first is we've got more time. No matter what your age, you've got more time ahead of you than past generations because of the increase in life expectancy. The second thing is the reason we're sort of living longer and healthier for longer on average, and that's a very important qualifier, is that we discovered to a degree that age is malleable. There are things we can do to help how we age, how we exercise, we eat, the environment, how we live our life. And that means we're aging differently. Yes, there's more old people, but how we're aging is changing. And that's a great opportunity to be seized. And if you think about what's really happened, I say most of these years of extra life are healthy, not all of them. So the period at the end of the life has got longer, which is a challenge. But most of those years of life have been healthy. So what's really happened is we kind of added something on to middle age from sort of 50 plus. That's where most of those extra years of life have come from. And people tend to think that aging is about just the end of life's got longer. But really, it's about all of life. And the metaphor I always give is, you know, imagine your day went from being 24 to 32 hours long. That's not just about what you do differently at the end of the day. It's what you do different over the whole day. And that's, I think, the challenge we've got. How do you make the most of this longer life? And in particular, how do we invest in making sure that our future self is as healthy as possible? So there's new risk around, but there's also just great opportunities. But the public narrative tends to focus on the negative. Oh, we must be older because we're living longer. as opposed to the good news that we're living better. And the heart of all this is our reliance upon chronological age. We measure age chronologically. So, you know, how many candles in your birthday cake, which means if you're living for longer, you're kind of older. But we really need to think about biological age. How fit and healthy are we? And also, I would argue that we need to think in a more forward-looking manner. Not how many candles there are on our birthday cake, but how many more birthday cakes do we still have to come? And using that, people have got a lot more future they need to prepare for. So it's an opportunity.
So you've highlighted that the traditional view of the life course with three stages of life is outdated due to these longer lives that we're living. How does a multi-stage life unfold?
Yes, that's one of the themes I stressed in with Linda in the 100-year life. So time, to some extent, is a social convention. How we structure our life is something society works on to make the most of it. And in the 20th century, we invented two stages of life. We invented teenagers, because before then, we just had children and adults. And we invented retirement and pensioners. And with that came a three-stage life. Your first stage is about education. Then you get a job and you have this long career, but it's, you know, hopefully a linear career path with the promotion along the way. And then you have retirement. And that kind of worked pretty well for 70 years. But if a child today has a realistic expectation of living to 90 or 100, we've got a problem, because stretching that three-stage life is going to be very difficult. In particular, if you are going to be living to your 90s or 100, you'll probably be working to your early 70s. And of course, in the States, the number of people working in their 70s is rising very dramatically, and in their 50s and 60s. So that three-stage life then becomes a challenge, because that's a 50 or even 60-year career. And if you think about sort of doing the same job for 50, 60 years, there's a number of problems. The first is, will you be able to, or will technology come along and take away that job? The second is, again, will you be able to? Because many people think they can carry on working, but often lose their job in their 50s because firms tend to move on older workers because they mistakenly think they're less productive and more expensive. And then the other thing is, do you want to carry on doing the same thing? You know, perhaps you want to take a different path. Perhaps you want to have a more flexible style of life. So we say there's going to be a multi-stage life, a multi-stage career, a multi-stage life where you may have three or four different stages to your career. One may be focused around making money. One may be about balancing your family responsibilities. One could be doing something entrepreneurial. And of course, that's already beginning to emerge. You're seeing people 50 plus being one of the most popular age groups for starting up a company, for instance. And just as I said earlier, we invented teenagers and pensioners. We're starting to see people behave very differently in their 40s and their 50s and 60s and doing these mid-career transitions. Certainly, in response to 100 Year Life, so many people have come out to me and either said, yes, this is exactly what I've been doing, or saying, I realize now I've got another 25 years ahead of me. I need to reskill, retool, take a break, and do something else.
So listen to you talk about a multi-stage life, it's clear that it has far more transitions than the old model. How can people create a new map of life and get better at handling these transitions?
Yeah, and I think it's going to be a really big skill because, you know, the longer life goes on, I think, first of all, your ability to think long-term is going to become ever more important. Your ability to invest in your future self is going to be key. And that's something that not everyone finds easy. And then, as you say, transitions will become more common. So I think there's another thing. There's one, how do I plan for them? What can I expect and how do I deal with them? And I think one of the challenges here is that we don't really know how to live these long lives because our parents' generation aren't going to really give us much of a guide because we're on average living longer than them. So you need to look around and sort of see what people are doing, see what experiments are happening. Just as it took a long while to work out what to do with teenagers, and how they just spend their time, and how it took a long while to work out what retirement was, we're kind of exploring these sort of midlife transitions as well. Mark Friedman, who runs Encore.org, a great American organization, says we don't have a midlife crisis, we have a midlife chasm. We don't have the social institutions to support change. So looking around and seeing what others are doing, thinking, of course, what it is you want to do, I think is a really key thing. And then, of course, it's a question about how you then prepare for it. And I think sometimes these transitions are forced upon you because you have a plan and then something happens. You know, you may lose your job, you may get divorced, or you get ill. So some of those transitions are forced. Others you have to prepare for yourself. And both of them are challenging because they force you to sort of play with your identity, to sort of be someone different. And I think particularly the older you get, the more, you know, you define your habits, your identity by your habits and your job. And that can be very dangerous. So I think exploring other options, putting yourself amongst different people, discovering what others are doing, and approaching things with an open mind are critical. But most of the evidence on transition suggests it's really important to mix with people who are different from you, but also find people who are going through a similar transition at the same time. And it's also tricky because, of course, where you start from, you'll have lots of people who know you and who are similar to you, but they're probably not going to be the best people to help you through a change where you need to become something different. So it's reaching out and finding another cohort to be inspired and be supported by, which is challenging.
So with a multi-stage life, it seems that lifelong learning plays a central role. And in your book, you point out that it's not just about taking online courses. We should redesign our environment to support learning. That jumped out to me here in the middle of the pandemic. What makes for a supportive learning environment?
Yeah, and you know, I think this is a really key question because with this longer life, you know, there's a lot more self-reliance and a lot more need for your own inspiration to do things, and reinvention is going to become important. So how do you continue to learn? Now, you know, one of the things you think about children just learn kind of all the time. I'm not talking here just about going to school. Mm-hmm. It's just every day having opportunities to learn. I remember as a child thinking I would never master tying my shoelaces. And then, of course, you just get repeated opportunities to do it, and eventually you do. So I think it's that sort of building in small, frequent learning opportunities. But they are small and frequent, I think, are crucial. So avoid having to sort of make a decision, now I'm going to sit down and do something different. I think you've got to try and sort of make it easy. So, for instance, I'm learning guitar at the moment, and I have to say I'm finding it very hard. But if I leave my guitar out by the desk where I work, it's just very easy to pick it up and just do a few things. So it's those very simple opportunities. But I think the other thing that's challenging is that as adults, we are still learning about learning. There's a great long literature about how children learn, but there's less of a literature about how adults learn. But what we do know is adults need to be a little bit more in charge of their own learning syllabus. They need to make it much more practical and something that feeds into their day-to-day. But it is about creating a simple environment. So it could be, I said it's not all about online, but it could just be about logging on online every day so you get a pop-up with something to read for you, for instance. But again, I also think going outside and continually putting yourself into slightly different environments where you get familiar with dealing with things that aren't easy or aren't comfortable is another part of it. And, you know, that's going to vary from person to person how much of that they like. Some people might just want a little bit of that. Some people may want to throw themselves into it.
That makes a lot of sense. It sounds like, too, it's a balancing act between making it easier and making it challenging enough.
Yeah, and here, I mean, you know, I'm an economist, and there's lots of psychologists who are focused in this. And there is some evidence, I was talking to them the other day, who says actually often it's the abrupt changes that you didn't plan for that throw you into a new environment where at first you get a little bit lost, but then you learn quickly. I guess it's like getting thrown into the deep end as a swimmer. Often, sometimes, the most effective ways of learning.
How important is it for people to build this as they age, as opposed to starting to try something and learn something at an older age? It seems to me like if they have a learning habit earlier in their lives, it becomes easier for them to do. Would I be correct?
I think that's right. And this, again, I think is one of the issues about this longer life. There's a temptation to see sort of, oh, we'll just do more education a bit later on. But so much of this longevity stuff unwinds and affects what you do at the beginning. So, for instance, if I know as a 20-year-old, that in my life I'm going to have to do some further studying, it changes what I learn when I'm 20. I may want to study less now because I know I'm doing more later. It also, I think, means I need to learn how to unlearn because, you know, I've got to learn different ways of doing things. So it's not just about learning earlier on. It's also learning about how to unlearn and get rid of habits. So I think that, you know, that's one of the key things. And one of the things that educational psychologists discovered is the brain is more capable of learning later than we thought. There was a notion that, you know, had a fixed set of brain cells and they die off as you get older. But there's a concept of neuroplasticity, that your brain can kind of regrow some of its connections and change. And to do that, of course, you've got to keep into the practice of keep learning and facing new things. So that I think is really important. The learning to unlearn. And as you say, just constantly being adaptable and flexible. Because the more you go through transitions, the more comfortable you are, I think, at further transitions.
You mentioned technology before, and I'm curious, what impact do you think artificial intelligence, AI, and technology will have on longer lives? Another way I could ask it is, will robots become the boss of me?
Yeah. So I think there's two aspects to that. I think one is about AI and robotics directly supporting longevity. And they can do that in a number of ways. One is, you know, one of the key things about longevity is keeping well. So we kind of need a health system that focuses upon preventing people getting ill rather than treating them when they get ill, which is our current health system. So we have a big switch towards preventative health. And that's where I think AI can play a huge role. You know, our phones have so much health data that they can monitor, and that's going to get a massive industry going forward. So just AI monitoring your body, monitoring your heart rate, how you sleep, your heart rate variability, et cetera, and giving warning signs. So I think there's a lot, self-diagnosis so that you can tackle a problem early rather than have to wait to go to hospital when you're ill. And then there's great hope around AI coming up with all sorts of new inventions and new drugs, because it can just so quickly test out various compounds and find out what works. So I think there's a positive role for AI in health. But then, of course, there's the bigger issue about AI and tech and our jobs. At one level, AI and robotics are great, particularly for older workers. Robots help people stay in the factory for longer. They can do a lot of the harder physical work. And AI is a great sort of cognitive prosthetic. When I forget something, I can just ask Siri and it can tell me. So there's sort of various ways in which you can support a longer career. But clearly, we're going to have a big change in the jobs. And in the New Long Life, the later book, we sort of fold together two trends. One is, oh, my career's got longer. But the second is technology, which means there's going to be a lot more churn in the labor market. And there's a lot of focus about how many jobs will get lost because of AI and robotics. And clearly, some jobs will get lost. But there's another thing that's going to happen is that even the jobs that aren't affected, aren't lost through technology, you're going to require changing what you do. What we're going to see is machines are getting better at being machine-like. So the jobs that we as humans do are going to have to use our human skills more. So, you know, any job you do is made up of a number of tasks, and some of those tasks can be automated and be done by AI and robotics. The other tasks, the things that are harder to automate, the things that humans are good at, they're going to expand and become more and more part of the role. So I talked about health a moment ago. Machines will do more and more of the diagnosis. And so doctors are going to have to do much more of the talking to the patient, trying to get them to accept the diagnosis, find out how they can best be supported in going through the treatments, et cetera. So we're going to see a real shift in the labor market in terms of what jobs are and how we go about doing those jobs. And so there's going to be a lot of churn, some jobs lost, new jobs being created. So if you think about those two trends of technology and longevity, your career has kind of got longer, your book of life's got longer, but the chapters are likely to get shorter with more change and more transitions. And those transitions will be sometimes about doing a different job, but also you're going to see what I think what the nature of work and a job change. We're seeing this, of course, with COVID right now, but sometimes your job will be a job where you go to a physical place and you get paid a salary and you do a range of tasks. Other times you might be working more flexibly, perhaps at home and not have a place to go to. Other times you may be, you know, like an Uber driver, the gig economy, and actually there's just a task. I'm just driving someone. I haven't got a job, but I get paid to do a certain number of tasks. So this cycle of whether I'm in a job or getting paid for tasks, whether I'm physically at a location or working remotely, you're going to see in your career all these different stages at different points in time. It's a much more complicated career path than we're used to. And so navigating through that is going to be challenging. It also, to me, suggests that what we call work is going to change. Currently, work is the thing we do that we get paid for. But work is going to be a whole bunch of things we do that sometimes we're getting paid for. But other times, it's like, you know, I'm learning a new skill so that I can get a new job or I can stay in my job or I'm networking or I'm making connections. So if you like, your leisure time will be split into two. There'll be the leisure, And then there'll be work, some of which is paid, but a lot of it is actually just maintaining your productive skills for these future stages. It's a very different path and one which requires a lot more self-reliance.
And you point out that institutions are much slower to adapt to longer lives than perhaps certain individuals. And how will our governments, educational systems, and corporations need to change with longer lives?
Well, it's pretty fundamental, I think, isn't it? I mean, I'm very wary of business school professors saying everything's about to change, because normally I don't think that's actually the case. But I do think we're at a period which will be a bit akin to the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution fundamentally rewired society, it changed the nature of work. In fact, it kind of invented the place of work. Beforehand, people used to work from home, a bit like many people are doing now. It created work and leisure, a workplace and a home, a working career. So much of our way of life was designed around the Industrial Revolution. And over 50 or 60 years, society sort of worked out how best to use this new technology in a way that worked for the economy, but also worked for people. And a whole raft of institutions and regulations were introduced to make that work. And I think we're going to see something similar with this combination of longer lives and technology. It's pretty clear that our existing institutions are no longer providing the support and security they used to. So we're in this political process of change. So what will need to happen? I mean, governments, there's lots individuals can do. We've kind of gone through some of those things. But governments will have a role to play. And part of that, I think, is around making sure that they can provide good support for preventative health. Making sure that people age well is going to be so important given the number of old people we're set to have in the years ahead. So a health system focused on keeping people well and not treating them when they get ill. In the UK, we have what's called a national health system, but the Minister of Health calls it a national hospital system rather than a national health system. It's about people going to hospital when they're ill. If we're really serious about health, we don't want people to get into hospital. And of course, COVID has made that all the clearer. The second thing governments will have to try and do is support, if people are healthier for longer, support them working for longer. And there's all sorts of challenges there. Older workers like more flexible working. There's lots of ageism and discrimination in the workplace. And there's all sorts of challenges around interactions with Social Security. And of course, the fact that not everyone ages well. So we have to deal with that diversity in a crucial way. Educational institutions, I think, are going to have to change pretty big time. Our education system is really set up to focus on people up to, let's say, 21. But if we have this lifelong learning, then we have to think about all those other people. And there's roughly 10 times more people from 25 to 75 than there are under 25 in the United States. So this is a huge market opportunity for someone, but it will require thinking about adult learning rather than beginning of life learning. And I think a lot of that will be very employment focused. It will be short courses, probably not degree orientated. And the need to have these what are called stackable and portable credentials. So I learn a little bit here and I build on them and stack them over time so that my qualifications become apparent over a longer period of time. And then companies have, I think, a lot to do here. One is changing to a more flexible approach to hiring and firing people. They currently tend to look obsessively at recruiting younger people. We're going to have to think about onboarding people at all sorts of different stages of life. And also the ability to ramp up and ramp down depending upon what your outside circumstances are. The really big one for me, I mean, I touched on longevity, but is around technology. And, you know, you said earlier, well, we'd be slave to the robots. I don't think so. And I do think that the fact that we're living longer and are healthier for longer is a good thing. And the fact we have these wonderful machines coming along should also be a good thing. But someone once said, demography isn't destiny. And neither is technology. So we need to think long and hard about how we implement technology. And in particular, we have to make sure that we don't focus on technology that automates everything and tries to get rid of humans from the process. There's a bit of a Silicon Valley view that humans are kind of error prone. And so progress is getting rid of humans in the process. I think what we need to make sure is that AI and robotics augment the individual so we can focus on the things we're good at and really add value. So I mentioned earlier about doctors, the same thing will be about teachers. There's much that can be automated with AI and robotics in the teaching process. But it'd be a great shame if all we did was automation and got rid of teachers. Teachers have got a great opportunity now. If the routine work is being dealt with by the machine, like the grading, for instance, then the teacher can focus on what they have a comparative advantage in compared to a machine, which is that human skill of recognizing what a student needs and how they need to be encouraged and how they need to be advanced. So we've got to make sure that corporates, but also governments, that we don't give firms an incentive to use technology just to automate things, but also give an incentive to augment things. So much of the technology I interact with at the moment is pretty poor, but it's there not because it's good, but because it's cheap. And I think that's a very dangerous path to go down. So we need to make sure that firms think about how they can use AI and robotics to augment the worker, not replace them, and actually therefore provide a better service ultimately to the customer.
So how do you see intergenerational relationships evolving in the future?
So I think it's a really interesting one because we've got this extraordinary demographic change happening. So there's fewer, you know, people being born, more people living for longer. So what used to be called demographic pyramids, you know, the structure of a population with lots of young people at the bottom and not many old people at the top, is kind of being inverted in many countries. You're going to see more old people than young. So that's leading to some tensions, you know, the sort of okay boomer type thing that the old are taking from the young, which I think is unfortunate because actually what's going to happen now is not just that reversal of the age pyramid, but people are living longer. So you've got more generations alive at the same point in time. In the UK, we talk about the sandwich generation. I don't know if you do in the US as well. The generation sandwiched between their children and their parents. Well, now you're going to have many more four-generation households. So you're going to have the club sandwich generation. You know, you've got children, parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents. And so, you know, when I was young, I used to go to family parties in London. They were typical London parties. There'd be lots of younger people, not many old. Now, because of the fall in the birth rate, there's far fewer younger people, a lot more older. So we need to really work on those intergenerational linkages much, much more. And I think we're going to, some societies, UK and US, I think may struggle with that because that three-stage life we talked about earlier led to a lot of age segregation. We really separated out the young, those of working age, and then the retired. And of course, the famous retirement communities in particular led to that separation. And I think that's been unhealthy. I think that's one of the reasons, for instance, we're so keen on these generational labels like Gen X and millennials and baby boomers. You know, I think because the different generations don't mix so much, there's a curiosity about what the old are like or what the young are like. And we come up with these sort of rather ridiculous generalizations that, you know, or Gen X like avocado or something like that. And it's a sort of, I think, a really unhelpful stereotyping because clearly, you know, Gen X is millions of people and there's a great deal of variety in them, just as there is amongst baby boomers. And so I find that generational label is really unhelpful because it too easily slips into intergenerational conflict, whereas socially one of the most important things we need to work on is intergenerational connections.
So finally, I'm curious about your thoughts about what we're learning from the pandemic that relates to longer lives. And a follow-up, if there's anything that you're personally doing differently now that you'd like to keep when it's over?
Yeah, that's a great question. So COVID is this huge multidimensional shock, isn't it? I mean, I have to say, you know, it's a terrible thing, but one of the few positives is that we finally learned the meaning of the word disruption. We've always heard that technology is going to disrupt this and this is going to disrupt that. But COVID really is a true disruptor. And I think it's done two things. One is it's accelerated a whole bunch of trends, like, you know, how do we work with technology? And also aging, because if you look at who is the fatality rate from COVID, it's like a viral attack of aging. It disproportionately affects older people, just like aging does. And in accelerating those two trends of technology and longevity, it's also acted as a stress test. It's revealed which countries, which individuals, which cities are well placed to cope with technology and longevity, not always with great results. So in the UK and the US, care homes have suffered terribly. And clearly, societies are not well placed to deal with the number of older people we've got living in those care homes, and something needs to be done. I think for me, what's been interesting as an aging specialist and longevity specialist is seeing the following. The first is, this is the first pandemic when the world population has had more people aged over 65 than under 5. First time we've had a pandemic with so many old people. And I think that's changed how we've responded to this pandemic. I don't think we'd have shuttered the economy in the same way if this had occurred 100 years ago when there really weren't many people aged over 65. Because we had so many people aged over 65, we had to protect a lot of human life by cratering the economy. But then I think what's interesting is that willingness to see these huge recessions as the price to pay to save lives shows us that actually we really do care about older people and aging. And so we need to think going forward, if that's how much value we put on these lives, how do we make sure people age well? And I think that's also been a part of the shift in the debate, because when the pandemic first hit, a lot of people were saying, well, let's just deny medical care to people aged 65 because they're old and they haven't got much time left to live. And I've seen two themes develop around that argument. The first is recognizing that someone who's 65, even in sort of relatively poor health, still has a lot of years left of life. So 65 really isn't that old anymore. The second thing is recognition that although age does matter, diversity is the key thing about aging. People age very differently. And some people who are fit and healthy in older age really aren't going to be very vulnerable, whereas others in poor health will. Which then, of course, raises the importance of making sure that you work as hard as you can in supporting your health in the future. So I guess, you know, ask me what I want to do during COVID. In right about longevity, I'd sort of realized this need to invest more in my future self. So I've been trying a lot more to exercise and to get rid of some sporting injuries that affect me. And so I'm still maintaining that. I think to me, the personal thing about COVID has been interesting is just forcing me to be at home more. I used to travel an awful lot, go to lots of meetings. And it's kind of reassessed what's important and what matters to you. And in particular, the importance of the local community. As you spend less time at work, you spend more time at home. And the way technology is going, that may be something for the future. So I think making sure that you focus on, you know, the family, the relationships outside of work and your local community are really, really important. Particularly given what I was saying earlier about the need for intergenerational relationships and also the way in which the workplace will become a less central part of your life. Because you've got this multi-stage career. So your identity will therefore be much more about the journey and those around you rather than just your work identity. So I guess that will be something that I want to try and persevere with afterwards. It's been a good wake-up call in that regard.
And there's also the guitar.
I think I will need a 100-year life to master the guitar. I really am struggling with that one. But
I started to take guitar lessons about a year ago. I unfortunately gave up. I don't think my brain works the way that you're supposed to work with the guitars. I'm looking at chords. But I did have one other question for you, if you don't mind. It seems like there's so much here that people need to reflect upon, and really appreciate everything you shared. I can certainly, this is such a great topic. What I'm hearing a lot of this is job one for people as they need to age better and as they need to pay attention to their age, or job one or two. But one is the importance of health and staying healthy throughout their lives will help them so much better into their longer lives. And the importance of community is the other thing I heard. Do I have that right? That's kind of what I'm hearing that people can focus on.
Yeah. So in the 100-year life, we say if you really want to do long-term planning and you think about two groups of assets, and one is your financial assets, which are obviously important. And if you're living longer, you're going to have to work for more longer and save more. But you're going to need that money at different points in your life. It's not just about a pension. You may need it for a mid-career break, for a transition course, all sorts of things. But that's the financial assets. But the other thing is that the real secret we've learned is this malleability of age. And that's about investing in your future self in another way. So there are your intangible assets. And your intangible assets, we think of three forms. One is their productive assets, your skills and knowledge, and you've got to keep investing in those. Second are your vitality assets, which I think of as having two groups. One is your health and fitness, and the other is your friends and family and relationships. We all know that the thing that makes a good life from study after study is not money. Money makes you happier. It doesn't make you happy. It's the words of the Grant study from Harvard. What makes you happy is the capacity to love and be loved. And so investing in those relationships is key. And then the final asset, which we touched on earlier on, your transitional, transformational assets, your ability to deal with change. But absolutely, you know, what we know about aging well is it's about your health, it's about your relationships, and it's about your sense of purpose. And money is an important part of that. But I think one of the challenges of the three-stage life is we think the third stage is all about acquiring money to support that third stage. When you have a multi-stage life, you need to think about money in a different way. You're going to need to allocate it differently. And you have a broader portfolio. And what you, of course, want is you want to finances to support the life you want rather than your life support the finances you want. And so investing in health, friendships, and purpose, really, really key.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights and wisdom with us. I know it's going to be very helpful to many people.
My pleasure. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you very much for the chance.
Well, that was a great podcast with Professor Andrew Scott. Very much enjoyed that. A lot of information in here. Joe, what were your takeaways today?
Well, there are so many because it's a rich discussion and his work with Linda Gratton is so intensive and relevant to what we're all living through and looking forward to. So the first thing that jumped out to me was he really gave us a sense of the scale of this change that's underway. And by the way, it's not something that's just in the future. It's happening now. We're living these changes. And he really referenced the Industrial Revolution, which gives us a sense of the potential impact of this in terms of changing the way of life. And I would tie that to his comment about, it's really about how are you going to invest in the future you? Because it's going to be a different world, a changing world that we're living in. And he really talked about the three-part life in the old model. And I think many people are still in their heads stuck in that model. You go to school when you're young, you go off to work, and then you retire, probably somewhere around 65. And that's changed. We all know that. We've talked about it on many podcasts and all of our guests have. But what he's talking about is this multi-stage life where there are multiple phases within each stage. So for example, people are going to have multiple careers. I read something that Rodney Brooks wrote the other day talking about, according to the Department of Labor, the average baby boomers have 12 jobs. So again, this is something that we're going through. And retirement's going to be the same thing. With Ted Carr on, he talked about six stages of retirement. There's going to be multiple retirements. He's going to flex in and out of different things. But the other point that he made that I wanted to amplify, and that's aging is more malleable than we first thought, including how we learn in brain science in terms of neuroplasticity. Really, we are continuing to learn all the way throughout our lives. And this multi-stage life really bringing in more transitions. And we had Bruce Feiler on recently about that and really talking about it as a skill, something that we need to be good at to really succeed in going forward. And that brings us to learning. That's really about continuing learning, continuing investing in yourself, and really unlearning. He mentioned habits. They would have to unlearn some habits and learn some new ones. And we've had B.J. Fogg on talking about that as well. And then the final point is age diversity, that generational cohorts are not just homogenous. There's a lot of different types of people in the baby boomer generation, millennials, Gen X, et cetera. And then his point about people age differently within those cohorts and that intergenerational relationships are going to be key going forward. Those are the things that jumped out to me. How about you?
That's a great summary of everything. Just a question and an observation. I see the responsibility for leading this change or this shift from the traditional retirement model, the three-stage model, into this multi-stage model, that's partly on us boomers to become role models for this. And I'm curious, what evidence or things do you see of that today?
I see some things in the clients that I work with in terms of the ones who are doing really well are investing in their future selves. They're, you know, getting into things he talked about in terms of their developing their skills, knowledge, their, you know, their health and their relationships. But I also would highlight the FIRE movement because I think the values that are underlining that with younger people up to and including baby boomers who are rejecting kind of that old model and keeping up with the Joneses, et cetera, but really advancing things to create more and leverage more of the freedom. So I think that they figured out the freedom part very early and are in the process of upending that way of life.
Oh, interesting. Thanks. I appreciate that. At the risk of repeating some things, which I will try not to do, at the beginning, he spoke about that aging is not about the end of life. It's about all your life. You hit on that with the different stages people need to go through, and they really need to adjust to this and throughout their lives. So I think that was important. we talked a lot about how technology will impact work, but what stuck with me was specifically was he said, what we call work today is going to change, and it's going to be some mix of paid work versus maintaining your productive skills. Once again, that's a reminder how important that lifelong learning is. At the end of the podcast, he was kind enough to represent some of the important assets, and not just the financial assets, because he did definitely mention that, you know, money is not the end all for this, but he mentioned these non-financial things that are important. And I kind of looked at these as key foundational things. And he summarized it with saying the importance of health, relationships, and purpose. We've heard that many times in not only people we talk to, but in the guests that we've had on this show, the importance of those fundamental foundational things, and that being able to be flexible enough to create your future self and being paying attention to your skills, your vitality, your friendships, and the way you handle your transformational skills, the way you're able to adapt, I think was just so important.
Thank you very much for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.